and for the first time she looked Strike directly in the eye. "I don't really know why I asked you to come," she confessed. "It's all confused in my head. They said she wrote to you, but you never wrote back, and then you got sent her...
"It must have been an appalling shock to you," said Strike, fully aware that anything he could say would understate the case.
"It's been," she said feverishly, "terrible. Terrible. We didn't know anything, anything at all. We thought she was on a college placement. When the police came to the door, she said she was going away with college, and I believed her. Some residential placement at a school. It sounded right, I never thought. But she was such a liar. She lied all the time. 3 years she's been living with me, and I still haven't... I mean, I couldn't get her to stop."
"What did she tell lies about?" asked Strike.
"Anything," said Hazel, with a slightly wild gesture. "If it was Tuesday, she'd say it was Wednesday. Sometimes there was no point to it at all. I don't know why. I don't know."
"Why was she living with you?" Strike asked.
She was my half-sister. Same mum. We lost Dad when I was 20. Mum married a guy from work and had Kelsey. There were 24 years between us. I'd left home. I was more like an auntie to her than a sister. Then Mum and Malcolm had a car crash out in Spain 3 years ago. Drunk driver. Malcolm died outright, Mum was in a coma for 4 days, and then she passed too. There isn't any other family, so I took Kelsey in."
The extreme tidiness of their surroundings, the cushions on their points, surfaces clear and highly polished, made Strike wonder how a teenager had fitted in here.
"Me and Kelsey didn't get on," said Hazel, again seeming to read Strike's thoughts.
Tears flowed once more as she pointed upstairs, where Ray had gone to bed.
"He was much more patient with all her moodiness and her sulks. He's got a grown-up son who's working abroad. He's better with kids than me. Then the police come jackbooting in here," she said on a sudden rush of fury, "and tell us she's been... They start questioning Ray like he'd ever, in a million years. I said to him, it's like a nightmare. You see people on the news, don't you, appealing for kids to come home? People put on trial for things they never did. You never think. You never think. But we never even knew she was missing. We'd have looked. We never knew. The police asking Ray questions, where he was, and I don't know what."
"They told me he didn't have anything to do with it," Strike said.
"Yeah, they believe that now," said Hazel, through angry tears. "After three men told them he was with them every minute of the stag weekend and showed them the bloody photos to prove it."
She would never think it reasonable that the man who had been living with Kelsey should be questioned about her death. Strike, who had heard the testimony of Brittany Brockbank and Rona Lang and many others like them, knew that most women's rapists and killers were not strangers in masks who reached out of the dark space under the stairs. They were the father, the husband, the mother's or the sister's boyfriend. Hazel wiped the tears away as fast as they fell onto her round cheeks, then suddenly asked,
"What did you do with her silly letter anyway?"
"My assistant put it in the drawer where we keep unusual correspondence," said Strike.
"The police said you never wrote back to her. They said they was forged, the letters they found."
"That's right," said Strike.
"So whoever done it must have known she was interested in you."
"Yes," said Strike.
Hazel blew her nose vigorously, then asked,
"Do you want a cuppa then?"
He accepted only because he thought she wanted a chance to pull herself together. Once she had left the room, he looked around openly. The only photograph stood on a small nest of tables in the corner beside him. It showed a beaming woman in her 60s wearing a straw hat. This, he assumed, was Hazel and Kelsey's mother. A slightly darker strip on the surface of the table beside the picture suggested that another had stood beside it, preventing the sun bleaching that small strip on the cheap wood. Strike guessed that this had been the school photograph of Kelsey, the picture that all the papers had printed. Hazel returned, carrying a tray bearing mugs of tea and a plate of biscuits. After she had carefully positioned his tea on a coaster beside her mother's photograph, Strike said, "I hear Kelsey had a boyfriend." "Rubbish," retorted Hazel, dropping back into her armchair. "More porkies." "What makes you?" "She said his name was Niall. Niall. Honestly." Her eyes leaked more tears. Strike was at a loss to understand why Kelsey's boyfriend might not have been called Niall, and his incomprehension showed. "One Direction," she said, over the top of her tissue. "Sorry," said Strike, completely at sea. "I don't." "The band. They're a band that came third on the X Factor. She's obsessed." "She was obsessed. And Niall was her favourite. So when she says she's met a boy called Niall and he's 18 and he's got a motorbike, I mean, what were we supposed to think?"
"Ah, I see."
"She said she met him at the counsellor's. She's been seeing a counsellor, see. Claims she met Niall in the waiting room, that he was there because his mum and dad died, like hers. We never saw hide nor hair of him. I said to Ray, 'She's at it again, she's fibbing.' And Ray said to me, 'Let it go, it keeps her happy.' But I didn't like her lying," said Hazel, with a fanatic glare. "She lied all the time. Came home with a plaster on her wrist, said it was a cut and it turned out to be a One Direction tattoo. Look at her saying she was going away on a college placement, look at that. She kept lying and lying, and look where it got her." With an enormous visible effort, she controlled a fresh eruption of tears, holding her trembling lips together and pressing the tissues hard across her eyes. Taking a deep breath, she said, "Ray's got a theory. He wanted to tell the police, but they didn't care. They were more interested in where he'd been when she was... But Ray's got a friend called Richie, who puts a bit of gardening his way, see? And Kelsey met Richie." The theory was rolled out with a huge amount of extraneous detail and repetition. Strike, who was well used to the rambling style of unpracticed witnesses, listened attentively and politely. A photograph was produced out of a dresser drawer, which did double duty in proving to Strike that Ray had been with three friends on a stag weekend in Shoreham-by-Sea when Kelsey was killed, and also revealed young Richie's injuries. Richie and Ray sat on the shingle beach beside a patch of sea holly, grinning, holding beers, and squinting in the sunlight. Sweat glistened on Ray's bald pate and illuminated young Richie's swollen face, his stitches and bruising. His leg was in a surgical boot. "And see, Richie came round here right after he'd had his smash, and Ray thinks it put the idea in her head. He thinks she was planning to do something to her leg and then pretend she'd had a traffic accident."
"Richie couldn't be the boyfriend, could he?" asked Strike.
"Richie? He's a bit simple. He'd have told us. Anyway, she barely knew him. It was all a fantasy. I think Ray's right. She was planning to do something to her leg again and pretend she'd come off some boy's bike." It would have been an excellent theory, thought Strike, if Kelsey had been lying in hospital, pretending to have suffered a motorbike accident and refusing to give more details under the pretense of protecting a fictitious boyfriend. He did Ray the credit of agreeing that this was exactly the kind of plan a 16-year-old might have come up with, mingling grandiosity and short-sightedness in dangerous measure. However, the point was moot. Whether or not Kelsey had once planned a fake motorbike crash, the evidence showed that she had abandoned the plan in preference for asking Strike for instructions on leg removal. On the other hand, this was the first time that anyone had drawn any connection between Kelsey and a motorcyclist. And Strike was interested in Hazel's absolute conviction that any boyfriend must be fictional. "Well, there was hardly any boys on her childcare course," said Hazel. "And where else was she going to meet him?" "Niall. She'd never had a boyfriend at school or anything. She went to the counsellor and sometimes she went to the church up the road. They've a youth group. But there's no Niall with a motorbike there," said Hazel. "The police checked.
asked her friends if they knew anything. Daryl, who runs the group, he was that upset. Ray saw him this morning on his way home. Says Daryl burst into tears when he saw him from across the road.
Strike wanted to take notes, but knew it would change the atmosphere of confidence he was trying to nurture.
Who's Daryl?
He didn't have anything to do with it. Youth worker at the church, he's from Bradford, said Hazel obscurely, and Ray's sure he's gay.
Did she talk about her... Strike hesitated, unsure what to call it. Her problem with her leg at home.
Not to me, said Hazel flatly. I wouldn't have it. I didn't want to hear it. I hated it. She told me when she was 14 and I told her exactly what I thought. Attention-seeking, that's all it was.
There was old scarring on her leg. How did that...
She did it right after Mum died. Like I didn't have enough to worry about. She tied wire around it, tried to cut off the circulation.
Her expression revealed a mixture, it seemed to Strike, of revulsion and anger.
She was in the car when Mum and Malcolm died, in the back. I had to get a counsellor and all that for her. He thought it was a cry for help or something, what she did to her leg. Grief. Survivor's guilt, I can't remember. She said not, though. Said she'd wanted the leg gone for a while. I don't know, said Hazel, shaking her head vigorously.
Did she talk to anyone else about it? Ray?
A bit, yeah. I mean, he knew what she was like. When we first got together, when he moved in, she told him some real whoppers. Her dad being a spy, that was one of them. And that was why their car had crashed, and I don't know what else. So he knew what she was like. But he didn't get angry with her. He just used to change the subject, chat to her about school and that. She had turned an unattractive dark red. I'll tell you what she wanted, she burst out. To be in a wheelchair, pushed around like a baby and to be pampered in the centre of attention. That's what it was all about. I found a diary, must have been a year or so ago. The things she'd written, what she liked to imagine, what she fantasised about. Ridiculous.
Such as? Asked Strike.
Such as having a leg cut off and being in a wheelchair and being pushed to the edge of the stage and watching One Direction and having them come and make a big fuss of her afterwards because she was disabled, said Hazel on a single breath. Imagine that. It's disgusting. There are people who are really disabled and they never wanted it. I'm a nurse, I know, I see them. Well, she said, with a glance at Strike's lower legs, you don't need telling. You didn't, did you? She asked suddenly point blank. You didn't. You didn't cut. Do it yourself.
Was that why she had wanted to see him, Strike wondered.
In some confused subconscious manner, trying to find her moorings in the sea on which he was suddenly adrift, had she wanted to prove a point, even though her sister was gone and beyond understanding, that people didn't do that, not in the real world where cushions stood neatly on points and disability came only by mischance, through crumbling walls or roadside explosives.
No, he said. I was blown up.
There you are, you see, she said, tears erupting again, savagely triumphant. I could have told her that. I could have told her if she'd asked me. But what she claimed, said Hazel, gulping, was that her leg felt like it shouldn't be there, like it was wrong to have it and it needed to come off, like a tumour or something. I wouldn't listen. It was all nonsense. Ray says he tried to talk sense into her. He told her she didn't know what she was asking for, that she wouldn't want to be in hospital like he was after he broke his back, laid up for months in plaster, skin sores and infections and all the rest of it. He didn't get angry with her, though. He'd say to her, come and help me in the garden or something. Distract her. The police told us she was talking to people online who were like her. We had no idea. I mean, she was 16. You can't go looking at their laptops, can you? Not that I'd know what to look for.
Did she ever mention me to you? Strike asked.
The police asked that. No. I can't remember her ever talking about you and Norcombe Ray.
I mean, no offence, but I remember the Lula Landry trial, but I wouldn't have remembered your name from that or recognised you. If she'd brought you up, I'd remember. It's a funny name. No offence.
What about friends? Did she go out much?
She hardly had any friends. She wasn't the popular sort. She lied to all the kids at school, too, and nobody likes that, do they? They bullied her for it. Thought she was strange. She hardly ever went out. When she was meeting the supposed Niall, I don't know.
Her anger did not surprise Strike. Kelsey had been an unplanned addition to her spotless household. Now, for the rest of her life, Hazel would carry guilt and grief, horror and regret, not least that her sister's life had been ended before she could grow out of the peculiarities that had helped estrange them.
"Would it be all right if I used your bathroom?" Strike asked.
Dabbing her eyes, she nodded. "Straight ahead, top of the stairs."
Strike emptied his bladder while reading a frame citation for Brave and Meritorious Conduct awarded to firefighter Ray Williams, which was hanging over the system. He strongly suspected that Hazel had hung that there, not Ray. Otherwise, the bathroom displayed little of interest. The same meticulous attention to cleanliness and neatness displayed in the sitting room extended all the way to the inside of the medicine cabinet, where Strike learned that Hazel was still menstruating, that they bulk-bought toothpaste, and that one or both of the couple had hemorrhoids. He left the bathroom as quietly as he could. Faintly, from behind a closed door, came a soft rumbling indicating that Ray was asleep. Strike took two decisive steps to the right and found himself in Kelsey's box room. Everything matched, covered in the same shade of lilac, walls, duvet, lampshade and curtains. Strike thought he might have guessed that order had been forcibly imposed on chaos in here, even had he not seen the rest of the house. A large cork notice board ensured that there would be no unsightly pin marks on the walls. Kelsey had plastered the cork with pictures of five pretty boys, whom Strike assumed were One Direction. Their heads and legs protruded outside the frame of the board. There was a particular recurrence of a blonde boy. Other than the pictures of One Direction, she had cut out puppies, mostly shih tzus, random words and acronyms, Occupy, FOMO, and Amazeballs, and many recurrences of the name Niall, often stuck into hearts. The slapdash random collage told of an attitude completely at odds with the precision with which the duvet had been laid on the bed and the exactly square position of the lilac rug. Prominent on the narrow bookshelf was what looked like a new One Direction, Forever Young, our official X Factor story. Otherwise, the shelves held the Twilight series, a jewellery box, a mess of small trinkets that not even Hazel had managed to make look symmetrical, a plastic tray of cheap makeup, and a couple of cuddly toys. Banking on the fact that Hazel was heavy enough to make a noise coming upstairs, Strike swiftly opened drawers. The police would have taken away anything of interest, of course. The laptop, any scrap of scribbled paper, any telephone number or jotted name, any diary, if she had continued to keep one after Hazel had gone snooping. A mishmash of belongings remained. A box of writing paper like that on which she had written to him, an old Nintendo DS, a pack of false nails, a small box of Guatemalan worry dolls, and, in the very bottom drawer of her bedside table, tucked inside a fluffy pencil case, several stiff, foil-covered strips of pills. He pulled them out, ovoid capsules in mustard yellow, labelled Accutane. He took one of the strips and pocketed it, closed the drawer, and headed to her wardrobe, which was untidy and slightly fusty. She had liked black and pink. He felt swiftly among the folds of material, rifling through the pockets of the clothes, but found nothing, until he tried a baggy dress, in which he found what looked like a crumpled raffle or coat check ticket, numbered 18. Hazel had not moved since Strike had left her. He guessed that he could have stayed away longer, and she would not have noticed. When he re-entered the room, she gave a little start. She had been crying again.
"Thank you for coming," she said thickly, getting to her feet. "I'm sorry, I..."
And she began to sob in earnest. Strike put a hand on her shoulder, and before he knew it, she had her face on his chest, sobbing, gripping the lapels of his coat, with no trace of coquettishness, but in pure anguish. He put his arms around her shoulders, and they stood so for a full minute until, with several heaving breaths, she stepped away again, and Strike's arms fell back to his sides. She shook her head, no words left, and walked him to the door. He reiterated his condolences. She nodded, her face ghastly in the daylight now falling into the dingy hall.
"Thanks for coming," she gulped. "I just needed to see you. I don't know why. I'm ever so sorry."
Chapter 35. Dominance and Submission. Since leaving home, he had cohabited with three women, but this one, it, was testing him to his limits. All three dirty bitches had claimed to love him, whatever that was supposed to mean. Their so-called love had turned the first two tractable. At heart, of course, all women were cheating cunts, determined to take more than they gave, but the first two hadn't been anything like it. He was forced to put up with more than he'd ever put up with before, because it was an essential part of his grand plan. Nevertheless, he constantly fantasized about killing it. He could imagine its stupid face slackening as the knife sank deep into her belly, unable to believe that baby, it called him baby, was killing her. Even as the hot blood began pouring over his hands, the rusty smell filling the air, still shivering with her screams. Having to play nice was playing havoc with his self-control. Switching on the charm, drawing them in, and keeping them sweet was easy. Second nature to him, always had been. Sustaining the pose over long periods, though, was something else. The pretense was bringing him to breaking point. Sometimes, even the sound of its breathing was enough to make him want to grab his knife and puncture her fucking lungs. Unless he got to do one soon, he'd fucking explode. Early on Monday morning, he made an excuse to get out. But as he approached Denmark Street, intending to pick up the secretary's trail as she arrived for work, something quivered in him, like the twitching of a rat's whiskers. He paused beside a telephone box on the opposite side of the road, squinting at a figure standing on the corner of Denmark Street, right outside an instrument shop painted in the garish colours of a circus poster. He knew the police, knew their moves, their games. A young man standing with his hands in the pockets of his donkey jacket was pretending to be casual, a mere bystander. He'd invented that fucking game. He could make himself practically invisible. Look at that dickhead, standing on the corner thinking his donkey jacket made him one of the lads. Never shit a shitter, pal. Slowly he turned and walked out of sight behind a telephone box, where he slid the beanie hat off his head. He'd been wearing it when Strike chased him. Donkey jacket might have a description. He should have thought of that, should have guessed Strike would call in his police mates, cowardly fucker. There's been no photo fit issued, though, he thought, his self-esteem rising again as he walked back down the street. Strike had come within feet of him, though he didn't realize it, and still had no fucking idea who he was. God, it would feel good after he'd done the secretary, to watch Strike and his fucking business sinking out of sight under the mudslide of the publicity, police and press crawling all over him, tainted by association, unable to protect his staff, suspected of her death, utterly ruined. He was already planning his next move, He would go to the LSE, where the secretary often followed the other blonde tart around, and hook up with her there. In the meantime, he'd need a different hat and perhaps new sunglasses. He felt in his pockets for money. He had hardly any, as fucking usual. He'd need to force it back out to work. He'd had enough of it whining and bleating and making excuses at home. In the end, he bought two new hats, a baseball cap and a grey woolen beanie, to replace the black fleece version he put in a bin at Cambridge Circus. Then he caught the tube to Holborn. She wasn't there, nor were any students. After searching fruitlessly for a glimpse of red-gold hair, he remembered that today was Easter Monday. The LSE was closed for the bank holiday. After a couple of hours, he returned to Tottenham Court Road, looking for her in the court, and skulked for a while near the entrance to Spearmint Rhino, but could not find her anywhere. After a run of days when he had been unable to get out and look for her, the disappointment caused him almost physical pain. Agitated, he began walking quiet side streets, hoping that some girl would stroll across his path, any woman at all. It didn't have to be the secretary. The knives beneath his jacket would be happy with anything now. Perhaps she had been so shaken up by his little greetings card that she had resigned. That wasn't what he wanted at all. He wanted her terrified and off balance, but working for Strike because she was his means of getting the bastard. In bitter disappointment, he returned in the early evening to it. He knew he was going to have to remain with it for the next 2 days, and the prospect was draining him of his last vestiges of control. If he could have used it in the way he planned to use the secretary, it would have been a different matter, a release. He would have hurried home, knives at the ready, but he dared not. He needed it alive and in thrall to him. Before 48 hours had passed, he was ready to explode with rage and violence. On Wednesday evening, he told it that he would have to leave early next day to do a job, and advised it bluntly that it was time it got back to work too. The resultant whining and mewling wore at him until he became angry. Cowed by his sudden rage, it tried to placate him. It needed him. It wanted him. It was sorry. He slept apart from it on the pretense of still being angry. This left him free to masturbate, but that left him unsatisfied. What he wanted, what he needed, was contact with female flesh through sharp steel. To feel his dominance as the blood spurted, to hear total submission in her screams, her pleas, her dying gasps and whimpers. Memories of the times when he had done it were no comfort. They merely inflamed his need. He burned to do it again. He wanted the secretary. He rose on Thursday morning at 4:45, got dressed, pulled on his baseball cap, and left to make his way across London to the flat that she shared with Pretty Boy. The sun had risen by the time he reached Hastings Road. An ancient Land Rover parked a short way from the house gave him cover. He leaned against it, keeping watch through the windscreen at the windows of her flat. There was movement behind the sitting room windows at 7, and shortly afterwards, Pretty Boy left in his suit. He looked drawn and unhappy. "You think you're unhappy now, you silly bastard. Wait until I've had my fun with your girlfriend." Then at last she appeared, accompanied by an older woman who greatly resembled her. "For fuck's sake. What was she doing going on outings with her fucking mother? It felt like mockery. Sometimes the whole world seemed like it was out to get him, to stop him doing things he wanted, to keep him down. He fucking hated this feeling that his omnipotence was seeping away, that people and circumstances were hemming him in, reducing him to just another thwarted, seething mortal. Somebody was going to pay for this. Chapter 36. I have this feeling that my luck is none too good. Blue Oyster Cult, Black Blade. When his alarm went off on Thursday morning, Strike extended one heavy arm and slapped the button on top of the old clock so hard that it toppled off his bedside table onto the floor. Squinting, he had to concede that the sunlight glowing through his thin curtains seemed to confirm the alarm's raucous assertion. The temptation to roll over and sink back into sleep was almost overwhelming. He lay with his forearm over his eyes for a few more seconds, blocking out the day. Then, with a mingled sigh and groan, he threw back the covers. As he groped for the handle of the bathroom door shortly afterwards, he reflected that he must have averaged 3 hours' sleep over the preceding 5 nights. As Robin had foreseen, sending her home had meant he had to choose between Tailing Platinum and Mad Dad. Having recently witnessed the latter jumping out at his small sons unexpectedly and seen their tears of fright, Stryker decided that Mad Dad ought to be prioritized. Leaving Platinum to her blameless routine, he had spent large parts of the week covertly photographing the skulking father, racking up image after image of the man spying on his boys and accosting them whenever their mother was not present. When not covering Mad Dad, Strike had been busy with his own investigations. The police were moving far too slowly for his liking, so, still without the slightest proof that Brockbank, Lang or Whittaker had any connection with Kelsey Platt's death, Strike had packed almost every free hour of the preceding 5 days with the kind of relentless, round-the-clock police work that he had previously only given the army. Balanced on his only leg, he wrenched the dial on the shower clockwise and allowed the icy water to pummel him awake, cooling his puffy eyes and raising goose flesh through the dark hair on his chest, arms and legs. The one good thing about his tiny shower was that if he slipped, there was no room to fall. Once clean, he hopped back to the bedroom where he toweled himself roughly and turned on the TV. The royal wedding would take place the following day, and the preparations dominated every news channel he could find. While he strapped on his prosthesis, dressed and consumed tea and toast, presenters and commentators kept up a constant, excitable stream of commentary about the people who were already sitting out in tents along the route and outside Westminster Abbey, and the numbers of tourists pouring into London to witness the ceremony. Strike turned off the television and headed downstairs to the office, yawning widely, and wondering how this multimedia barrage of wedding talk would be affecting Robin, who he had not seen since the previous Friday, when the Jack Vetriano card containing a grisly little surprise had arrived. In spite of the fact that he had just finished a large mug of tea upstairs, Strike automatically switched on the kettle when he arrived in the office, then put down on Robin's desk the list of strip joints, lap dancing clubs, and massage parlours he had begun compiling in his few free hours. When Robin arrived, he intended to ask her to continue researching and telephoning all the places she could find in Shoreditch, a job she could do safely from her own home. If he could have enforced her cooperation, he would have sent her back to Massam with her mother. The memory of her white face had haunted him all week. Stifling a second enormous yawn, he slumped down at Robin's desk to check his emails. In spite of his intention to send her home, he was looking forward to seeing her. He missed her presence in the office, her enthusiasm, her can-do attitude, her easy, unforced kindness, and he wanted to tell her about the few advances he had made during his dogged pursuit of the three men currently obsessing him. He had now notched up nearly 12 hours in Catford, trying to glimpse Whittaker entering or leaving his flat over the chip shop, which stood on a busy pedestrian street running along the rear of the Catford Theatre. Fishmongers, wig shops, cafes and bakeries curved around the perimeter of the theatre, and each had a flat above it, boasting 3 arched windows in triangular formation. The thin curtains of the flat, where Shanker believed Whittaker to be living, were constantly closed. Market stalls filled the streets by day, providing Strike with useful cover. The mingled smells of incense from the dreamcatcher stall and the slabs of raw fish lying on ice nearby filled his nostrils until he barely noticed them. For 3 evenings, Strike had watched from the stage door of the theatre opposite the flat, seeing nothing but shadowy forms moving behind the flat's curtains. Then, on Wednesday evening, the door beside the chip shop had opened to reveal an emaciated teenage girl. Her dark, dirty hair was pulled back off a sunken, rabbity face, which had the violet-shadowed pallor of a consumptive. She wore a crop top, a zip-up grey hoodie and leggings that gave her thin legs the look of pipe cleaners. Arms crossed tightly across her thin torso, she entered the chip shop by leaning on the door until it gave, then half falling into it. Strike hurried across the road so fast that he caught the door as it swung closed and took a place immediately behind her in the queue. When she reached the counter, the man serving addressed her by name.
"All right, Stephanie?"
"Yeah," she said in a low voice. "Two Cokes, please."
She had multiple piercings in her ears, nose and lip. After counting out payment in coins, she left, head bowed, without looking at Strike. He returned to his darkened doorway across the road, where he ate the chips he had just bought, his eyes never moving from the lit windows above the chippy. Her purchase of 2 Cokes suggested that Whittaker was up there, perhaps sprawled naked on a mattress, as Strike had so often seen him in his teens. Strike had thought himself detached, but the awareness as he stood in the chip shop queue that he might be mere feet from the bastard, separated only by a flimsy wood and plaster ceiling, had made his pulse race. Stubbornly, he watched the flat until the lights in the windows went off around 1 in the morning, but there had been no sign of Whittaker. He had been no luckier with Lang. Careful perusal of Google Street View suggested that the balcony on which the fox-haired Lang had posed for his Just Giving photograph belonged to a flat in Wollaston Close, a squat, shabby block of flats that stood a short distance from the strata. Neither phone nor voter registration records for the property revealed any trace of Lang, but Strike still held out hope that he might be living there as the guest of another, or renting and living without a landline. He had spent hours on Tuesday evening keeping watch over the flats, bringing with him a pair of night vision goggles that enabled him to peer through uncurtained windows once darkness fell, but saw no hint of the Scot entering, leaving, or moving around inside any of the flats. Having no wish to tip Lang off that he was after him, Strike had decided against door-to-door inquiries, but had lurked by day near the brick arches of a railway bridge nearby, which had been filled in to create tunnel-like spaces. Small businesses lived here. An Ecuadorian cafe, a hairdresser's. Eating and drinking silently among cheerful South Americans, Strike had been conspicuous by his silence and moroseness. Strike's fresh yawn turned into another groan of tiredness as he stretched in Robin's computer chair, so that he did not hear the first clanging footsteps on the stairs in the hallway. By the time he had realized that somebody was approaching and checked his watch, it was surely too early for Robin, who had told him her mother's train would leave at 11, a shadow was climbing the wall outside the frosted glass. A knock on the door, and to Strike's astonishment, 2 times entered the office. A paunchy, middle-aged businessman, he was considerably wealthier than his crumpled, nondescript appearance would suggest. His face, which was entirely forgettable, neither handsome nor homely, was today screwed up in consternation.
"She's dumped me,"
he told Strike, without preamble. He dropped onto the mock-leather sofa in an eruption of fake flatulence that took him by surprise, for the second time Strike assumed that day. It must have been a shock to the man to be dumped, when his usual procedure was to collect evidence of infidelity and present it to the blonde in question, thus severing the connection. The better Strike had got to know his client, the more he had understood that, for 2 times, this constituted some kind of satisfying sexual climax. The man appeared to be a peculiar mix of masochist, voyeur, and control freak.
Really? Said Strike,
getting to his feet and heading towards the kettle. He needed caffeine.
We've been keeping a very close eye on her, and there hasn't been a hint of another man.
In fact, he had done nothing about Platinum all week, except to take Raven's calls, a few of which he had allowed to go to voicemail, while he had been tailing Mad Dad. He now wondered whether he had listened to all of them. He hoped to Christ that Raven had not been warning him that another rich man had shown up, ready to defray some of Platinum's student expenses in return for exclusive privileges. Or he would have to say goodbye to two times his cash for good.
Why she dumped me then?
Demanded two times.
Because you're a fucking weirdo.
Well, I can't swear there isn't someone else, said Strike, choosing his words carefully as he poured instant coffee into a mug. I'm just saying she's been bloody clever about it if there is. We've been tailing her every move, he lied. Coffee?
I thought you were supposed to be the best, grumbled two times. No, I don't drink instant.
Strike's mobile rang. He pulled it out of his pocket and checked the caller. Wardle.
Sorry, I need to take this, he told his disgruntled client, and did so. Hi, Wardle.
Mally's ruled out, said Wardle. It was a mark of Strike's exhaustion that these words meant nothing to him for a second or two. Then the realization dawned that Wardle was talking about the gangster who had once cut off a man's penis, and of whose probable guilt in the matter of the leg Wardle had seemed convinced.
Digger, right, said Strike, to show that he was paying attention. He's out, is he?
It can't have been him. He was in Spain when she was killed.
Spain, repeated Strike.
Two times drummed his thick fingers on the arm of the sofa.
Yeah, said Wardle, bloody Menorca.
Strike took a swig of coffee so strong he might as well have emptied boiling water straight into the jar. A headache was building in the side of his skull. He rarely got headaches.
But we've made progress with those two's pictures I showed you, said Wardle. The bloke and the girl who were posting on that freaks website where Kelsey was asking questions about you.
Strike dimly remembered the pictures Wardle had shown him of a young man with lopsided eyes and a woman with black hair and glasses.
We've interviewed them and they never met her. They only had online contact. Plus, he's got a rock-solid alibi for the date she died. He was doing a double shift at Asda, in Leeds. We've checked.
But, said Wardle, and Strike could tell he was leading up to something he thought promising.
There's a bloke who's been hanging around the forum, calls himself Devotee, who's been freaking them all out a bit. He's got a thing for amputees. He liked to ask the women where they wanted to be amputated, and apparently he tried to meet a couple of them. He's gone very quiet lately. We're trying to track him down.
Uh-huh, said Strike, very conscious of two times mounting irritation.
Sounds hopeful.
Yeah, and I haven't forgotten that letter you got from the bloke who liked your stump, said Wardle. We're looking into him, too.
Great, said Strike. Hardly aware of what he was saying, but holding up a hand to show two times, who was on the verge of getting up from the sofa, that he was almost done.
Listen, I can't talk now, Wardle. Maybe later.
When Wardle had hung up, Strike attempted to placate two times, who had worked himself up into a state of weak anger while forced to wait for the phone call to end. Precisely what he thought Strike could do about the fact that his girlfriend had chucked him was a question that the detective, who could not afford to jettison possible repeat business, did not ask. Swigging tar-black coffee while the pain built in his head, Strike's dominant emotion was a fervent wish that he was in a position to tell two times to fuck off.
"So what," asked his client, "are you going to do about it?"
Strike was unsure whether he was being asked to force Platinum back into the relationship, track her all over London, in the hopes of discovering another boyfriend, or refund two times his money. Before he could answer, however, he heard more footsteps on the metal stairs and female voices. Two times barely had time for more than a startled, questioning look at Strike before the glass door opened. Robin looked taller to Strike than the Robin he kept in his memory. Taller, better looking, and more embarrassed. Behind her, and under normal circumstances he would have been interested and amused by the fact, was a woman who could only be her mother. Though a little shorter and definitely broader, she had the same strawberry blonde hair, the same blue-grey eyes, and an expression of beneficent shrewdness that was deeply familiar to Robin's boss.
"I'm so sorry," said Robin, catching sight of Two Times and halting abruptly. "We can wait downstairs. Come on, Mum."
Their unhappy client got to his feet, definitely cross.
"No, no, not at all," he said. "I didn't have an appointment. I'll go. Just my final invoice then, Strike."
He pushed his way out of the office. An hour and a half later, Robin and her mother were sitting in silence as their taxi moved towards King's Cross, Linda's suitcase swaying a little on the floor. Linda had been insistent that she wanted to meet Strike before she left for Yorkshire.
"You've been working with him for over a year. Surely he won't mind if I look in to say hello. I'd like to see where you work, at least, so I can picture it when you're talking about the office."
Robin had resisted as hard as she could, embarrassed by the very idea of introducing her mother to Strike. It felt childish, incongruous, and silly. She was particularly concerned that appearing with her mother in tow would reinforce Strike's evident belief that she was too shaken up to deal with the Kelsey case. Bitterly did Robin now regret betraying her distress when the Vetriano card had arrived. She ought to have known better than to let any hint of fear show, especially after telling him about the rape. He said it had made no difference, but she knew better. She'd had plenty of experience of people telling her what was and wasn't good for her. The taxi bowled along the inner circle, and Robin had to remind herself that it was not her mother's fault that they had blundered in on Two Times. She ought to have called Strike first. The truth was that she had hoped that Strike would be out or upstairs, that she would be able to show Linda around the office and take her away without having to introduce them. She had been afraid that if she phoned him, Strike would make a point of being there to meet her mother, out of a characteristic blend of mischief and curiosity. Linda and Strike had chatted away while Robin made tea, keeping deliberately quiet. She strongly suspected that one of the reasons Linda wanted to meet Strike was to assess the precise degree of warmth that existed between him and her daughter. Helpfully, Strike looked appalling, a good 10 years older than his real age, with that blue-jawed, sunken-eyed look that he got when he forfeited sleep for work. Linda would surely be hard-pressed to imagine that Robin was nursing a secret infatuation now she had seen her boss. "I liked him," said Linda, as the red brick palace of St. Pancras came into view. "And I have to say, he might not be pretty, but he's got something about him." "Yes," said Robin coldly. "Sarah Shadlock feels the same way." Shortly before they had left for the station, Strike had asked for 5 minutes with her alone in the inner office. There he had handed her the beginnings of a list of massage parlours, strip joints and lap dancing clubs in Shoreditch, and asked her to begin the laborious process of ringing them all in search of Noel Brockbank.
"The more I think about it," Strike had said, "the more I think he'll still be working as a heavy or a bouncer. What else is there for him? Big bloke with brain damage and his history."
Out of deference to the listening Linda, Strike had omitted to add that he was sure Brockbank would still be working in the sex industry, where vulnerable women might be most easily found.
"Okay," Robin had replied, leaving Strike's list where he had put it on her desk.
"I'll see Mum off and come back."
"No, I want you to do it from home. Keep a record of all the calls. I'll reimburse you."
A mental picture of the Destiny's Child survivor poster had flickered in Robin's mind.
"When do I come back into the office?"
"Let's see how long that takes you," he said.
Correctly reading her expression, he had added,
"Look, I think we've just lost two times for good. I can cover Mad Dad alone.
What about Kelsey?"
"You're trying to trace Brockbank," he said, pointing at the list in her hand. Then, his head was pounding, though Robin did not know it. "Look, everyone'll be off work tomorrow. It's a bank holiday, the royal wedding."
It could not have been clearer. He wanted her out of the way. Something had changed while she had been out of the office. Perhaps Strike was remembering that, after all, she had not been trained by the military police, had never seen dismembered limbs before a leg was delivered to their door, that she was not, in short, the kind of partner who was of use to him in this extremity.
"I've just had 5 days off." "For Christ's sake," he said, losing patience. "You're only making lists and phone calls. Why do you have to be in here to do it?"
"You're only making lists and phone calls." She remembered how Ellen had called her Strike secretary. Sitting in a taxi with her mother, a lava slide of anger and resentment swept away rationality. He had called her his partner in front of Wardle, back when he had needed her to look at the photographs of a dismembered body. There had been no new contract, though, no formal renegotiation of their working relationship. She was a faster typist than Strike, with his wide, hairy fingers. She dealt with the bulk of the invoices and emails. She did most of the filing, too. Perhaps, Robin thought, Strike himself had told Ellen that she was his secretary. Perhaps calling her partner had been a sop to her, a mere figure of speech. Maybe. She was deliberately inflaming her own resentment now, and she knew it. Strike and Ellen discussed Robin's inadequacies during their sneaky dinners away from Ellen's husband. He might have confided in Ellen how much he now regretted taking on a woman who, after all, had been a mere temp when she had come to him. He had probably told Ellen about the rape, too. "It was a difficult time for me, too, you know. You're only making lists and phone calls." Why was she crying? Tears of rage and frustration were trickling down her face.
"Robin?" said Linda.
"It's nothing, nothing," said Robin savagely, wiping under her eyes with the heels of her hands. She had been desperate to get back to work after 5 days in the house with her mother and Matthew, after the awkward three-cornered silences in the tiny space, the whispered conversations she knew that Linda had had with Matthew while she was in the bathroom, and about which she had chosen not to ask. She did not want to be trapped at home all over again. Irrational though it might have been, she felt safer in the middle of London, keeping an eye out for that large figure in the beanie hat, than she did in her flat in Hastings Road. They pulled up at last outside King's Cross. Robin was trying hard to keep her emotions under control, conscious of Linda's sideways looks as they crossed the crowded station towards her platform. She and Matthew would be alone again tonight, with the looming prospect of that final, definitive talk. She had not wanted Linda to come and stay, yet her imminent departure forced Robin to admit that there had been a comfort in her mother's presence that she had barely acknowledged. "Right," said Linda, once her case had been safely stowed in the luggage rack, and she had returned to the platform to spend the last couple of minutes with her daughter. "This is for you." She was holding out £500.
"Mum, I can't take..."
"Yes, you can," said Linda. "Put it towards a deposit on a new place to live, or a pair of Jimmy Choo's for the wedding." They had gone window shopping in Bond Street on Tuesday, staring through the shop windows at flawless jewels, at handbags that cost more than second-hand cars, at designer clothing to which neither woman could ever aspire. It felt a long way from the shops of Harrogate. Robin had gazed most covetously through the shoe shop windows. Matthew did not like her to wear very high heels. Defiantly, she had voiced a hankering for some 5-inch spikes.
"I can't," repeated Robin, as the station echoed and bustled around them. Her parents were sharing the expense of her brother Stephen's wedding later in the year. They had already paid a sizable deposit on her reception, which had been postponed once. They had bought the dress and paid for its alterations, lost one deposit on the wedding cars.
"I want you to," said Linda sternly, "either invest it in your single life or buy wedding shoes."
Fighting more tears, Robin said nothing. "You got Dad's and my full support, whatever you decide," said Linda.
"But I want you to ask yourself why you haven't let anyone else know why the wedding's off. You can't keep living in limbo like this. It's not good for either of you. Take the money. Decide."
She wrapped Robin in a tight embrace, kissed her just beneath the ear, and got back on the train. Robin managed to smile all the time she was waving goodbye, but when the train had finally pulled away, taking her mother back to Massam, to her father, to Roundtree the Labrador, and everything that was friendly and familiar, Robin dropped down on a cold metal bench, buried her face in her hands, and wept silently into the banknotes Linda had given her.
"Cheer up, darling. Plenty more fish in the sea."
She looked up. An unkempt man stood in front of her. His belly spilled widely over his belt, and his smile was lascivious. Robin got slowly to her feet. She was as tall as he was. Their eyes were on a level.
"Sod off," she said.
He blinked. His smile turned to a scowl. As she strode away, stuffing Linda's money into her pocket, she heard him shout something after her, but she neither knew nor cared what it had been. A vast, unfocused rage rose in her, against men who considered displays of emotion a delicious open door. Men who ogled your breasts under the pretense of scanning the wine shelves. Men for whom your mere physical presence constituted a lubricious invitation. Her fury billowed to encompass Strike, who had sent her home to Matthew because he now considered her a liability, who would rather endanger the business that she had helped build up, soldiering on single-handedly, than let her do what she was good at, what she sometimes outshone him at, because of the permanent handicap she had in his eyes acquired by being in the wrong stairwell at the wrong time 7 years previously. So yes, she would ring his bloody lap-dancing clubs and his strip joints in search of the bastard who had called her little girl. But there was something else she would do too. She had been looking forward to telling Strike about it, but there had been no time with Linda's train due, and she had felt no inclination after he told her to stay at home. Robin tightened her belt and marched on, frowning, feeling fully justified in continuing to follow one lead, unbeknownst to Strike, alone.
Chapter 37. This ain't the Garden of Eden. Blue Oyster Cult. This ain't the Summer of Love.
If she had to be at home, she supposed she would watch the wedding. Robin staked out a position on the sitting room sofa early next morning, her laptop open on her knees, her mobile beside her, the TV on in the background. Matthew, too, had the day off work, but he was in the kitchen, keeping out of her way. There had been no solicitor's offers of tea today, no questions about her work, no obsequious attentiveness. Robin sensed a change in him since her mother had left. He seemed anxious, wary, more serious. Somehow, during their quiet conversations, Linda appeared to have convinced Matthew that what had happened might never be repairable. Robin knew perfectly well that she needed to deliver the coup de grace. Linda's parting words had increased her sense of urgency. She had not yet found another place to live, but she must nevertheless tell Matthew that she was moving out and agree a form of words to issue to their friends and family. Yet here she sat on the sofa, working rather than dealing with the subject that seemed to fill the small flat, pressing against the walls, keeping the atmosphere perpetually stiff with tension. Commentators wearing buttonholes and corsages were babbling on screen about the decorations in Westminster Abbey. Famous guests snaked towards the entrance and Robin half listened as she noted down the telephone numbers for lap dancing clubs, strip joints, and massage parlours.